Welcome back to another episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska. This is Rob Prince with an exciting change of pace for today's episode. I've been essentially hogging the hosting of this radio show since it began back in 2014. So in this episode, I am very excited to introduce you to today's guest radio host, Brittany Carnes. Brittany took over hosting the live events in Fairbanks from me back in 2023. And fun fact, the live show has sold out every single time since she took over. She has literally never hosted a non-sold-out live event, if you can imagine that. That never happened when I hosted the events in Herring Auditorium. So since everyone loves her so much more than me, I decided it was time to let her host a Dark Winter Nights radio episode. I'd also like to note that today's episode was edited by another Dark Winter Nights executive producer and KUAC-FM veteran, Robin. And story consultation was by Lori Neufeld. They all did an awesome job, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Here's Brittany Carnes.
In this season 11 episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, Trent McNally tells us an unexpected story involving turkey, basketball, ESPN, and a homeless shelter.
It was a huge undertaking, one of the biggest jobs I did in a year. There were usually somewhere around 60 people working on the production. And since it was over Thanksgiving, we had some challenges feeding everybody on Thanksgiving Day.
And Nicole Allard shares a story about discovering how generous Alaskans can be to newcomers preparing to face a cold, harsh, interior Alaska winter.
And my partner and I decided that we would stick around for the winter and still had no idea what came next. Of course, this also meant that we didn't prepare for winter. Instead, we had spent all summer using our firewood in saunas and campfires and just having fun.
Season of Thanks. Up next on Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, I'm Brittany Carnes, sitting in this month for Rob Prince. A lot of people outside Alaska may not know what a basketball crazy state we are. Even our tiny 100-person villages off the road system have a basketball court, and it plays a significant role in community life. It's one of our most competitive high school sports, with student athletes flying hundreds of miles to compete against each other. After the recent devastation on the coast of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta by Typhoon Halong, shoes for basketball were one of the first things evacuees requested. Trent McNally spent his early career helping cover basketball in Alaska for ESPN, including one of our biggest and most popular basketball events of the year, the Great Alaska Shootout. Here's Trent.
And I've been working in television pretty much my whole adult life. I started out in Fairbanks in 1983, working for a small company called Alaska Mobile Productions, and in 88... I moved to Anchorage, and I've worked most of my career down here, but covering things all over the state. In 1989, I started working on a big basketball tournament that happened every year at Thanksgiving here in Anchorage called the Great Alaska Shootout. At the time, the NCAA had a rule about how many preseason tournaments could take place, and back then there were only two preseason tournaments allowed, the Maui Classic and the Great Alaska Shootout. So there were tons of teams that wanted to come up here and compete. We've got some really top-tier Division I basketball teams that came up and played in the tournament. It started on Wednesday before Thanksgiving. There were two games Wednesday, two games Thursday, and then four games Friday and four games Saturday. UAA, the local school, got to play, but all the other schools were Division I. In 1989, when I started working on the shows, ESPN was televising them nationwide. It was pretty much the only thing that was televised live nationwide from Alaska every year. I started out just as a crew person running camera. I did replay a couple of years, but within maybe 5 or 6 years, I was the local crew chief. I arranged all the local crew and facilities that ESPN used. It was a mix of equipment that was used here locally and things that were shipped in from the lower 48. It was a huge undertaking, one of the biggest jobs I did in a year. There were usually somewhere around 60 people working on the production. And since it was over Thanksgiving, we had some challenges feeding everybody on Thanksgiving Day. Most restaurants are closed, but we had a full 10 or 12 hour work day on Thanksgiving Day. So we hired caterers to come and set up a big Thanksgiving feast for us on Thanksgiving. We usually had it around noon, 12:30. We had games starting later in the afternoon. I think there was a 3 o'clock game and a 5 o'clock game on Thanksgiving Day. So that was really expensive. The university here in Anchorage was the one that paid the bills for everything. They got a rights fee from ESPN to televise the tournament. But then the university had to pay for everything. They paid for the television production. They paid for all the crews to travel. They paid for the teams. They paid for the team lodging. They paid for everything. It was a huge expense. But the university made pretty good money on it in the end. But it was my responsibility to do the very best I could to, you know, maximize the university's profit by keeping costs under control as best as we could. So for the first few years, I just went with the status quo and hired the caterer. But to cater a meal on Thanksgiving Day for, call it, 50 people would probably run back then, this would be in the early 90s, it'd be, you know, $40, $50 per person to have that meal arranged. And we paid for it because it was important that everybody be fed. But one year, the local grocery store chain, Carr's, advertised a special. They said that they could provide a full Thanksgiving meal for four people. That was turkey, potatoes, dressing, vegetables, salad, pie, the whole shoot and match, and a kit for the meal for four people was about $50. And I thought, this is it. This is our opportunity to save some serious money and have good food. The Carr's Deli made really good food. We ate there quite frequently myself, and they always made good food. So I ordered up, I believe it was 12 of these four-person meal kits. And the catering department there at Carr's told me they'd be ready for pickup first thing Thanksgiving morning. The store was open. So as a part of our crew, I had a person whose official job title was runner. And her job was just to run around and do errands that needed to be done. Usually it was picking things up that had been missed. One time she even got somebody's birth control prescription filled at a pharmacy, but that's a whole nother story. Usually it was going to the store and getting us more snacks, you know, picking up batteries that we needed for wireless microphones, things like that. And I said, okay, Jean, her name was Jean Reardon at the time, and this would have been 97, 98, something like that. I said, Jean, you got to run over to Carr's and pick up all these Thanksgiving meals, bring them back. We'll have tables set up so we can spread out the chow and everybody can eat. And Jean headed out. It was like 9:30, 10 in the morning to go pick up the meals. And about a half hour later, she calls me from her cell phone and says, Trent, there's a real problem here. These meals are all frozen solid. They were pre-cooked, but they were frozen like a big brick. And it was going to take hours to thaw everything out. And we're working at the Sullivan Arena. There are no kitchens that we could get into there. There were no, you know, ovens we could heat up. And there was no way we were going to make that work. And this was a pretty big crisis. We had some pretty high power talent from ESPN in town that, you know, was counting on having their meal in a couple hours. And I was just at a loss. It was like I was about to tell her, okay, well, you know, get a lot of bologna and bread and we're going to have a sandwich bar. But she said, I've got an idea. Let me follow up on it. And I said, okay, make it fast. She called me back a few minutes later and she said, I've talked to the Brother Francis shelter where they prepare Thanksgiving meals for the homeless people. And they have a ton of food all cooked and ready to go. And she said that she had offered to trade them these prepackaged Thanksgiving meals along with a cash donation if they would give us enough food to feed 50 people from their supplies. And they said, sure. So Jean went over. I think she got another couple people to help. And she came back with great big aluminum trays full of really good food. It was great. We had a couple of whole turkeys that had been roasted, big, huge vats of potatoes, dressing. There was a couple of vegetable dishes. There was fresh bread. We had butter, salad dressing. We already had all the paper plates and utensils that we needed, but all the actual food items came from the homeless shelter. And up until this point, I, of course, hadn't said a word to anybody at ESPN that there was a risk of not having much of a meal. And so everybody, you know, bellied up to the bar and filled up their plates. And ESPN every year would have one of their photographers take some video of it, and they would play back a few clips during halftime of one of the games. You know, earlier today, we got to eat a great feast provided by our local blah, 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 blah. As everyone was eating, I pulled the producer aside and I told him, I said, well, we almost didn't get to eat. And he was all goggle-eyed. And I told him the story and he laughed out loud. And before long, he had told, you know, all 30 people that had traveled from outside the state to be part of the crew, including the announcing team. They all thought it was great. And during the game, they talked about it on air that, you know, we had a great meal. We shared our meal with the homeless people of Anchorage, and they were eating top shelf stuff. For years afterward, I continued to work on the tournament up through 2015 was the last year I worked on it. So I had coming up on 30 years in working on that. The legend lived on all the way to the end. Later on, ESPN was no longer broadcasting, and the broadcaster turned to CBS, and it was CBS Sports. But they, too, had heard the story about the year that we ate the homeless food for Thanksgiving. Needless to say, after that, I went back to hiring the caterer and just bit the bullet and paid for the more expensive meal option. But it was a story that everybody laughed about, and we had a good time sharing. And thankfully, everybody got to eat a decent meal that year.
Trent McNally. This is Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Season of Thanks episode. I'm Brittany Carnes. We are always actively looking for more great Alaskan stories. If you or someone you know has a great true story from Alaska that you'd like to share with us, you can email us at story@darkwinternights.com or contact us through our website. We tell stories so much differently in spoken word than we do on the written page. Our favorite way to receive stories is just a quick and simple audio recording of you telling that story on something like a smartphone and email it to us. That helps us to get a much better sense for the tone of your story and for you as a storyteller. Our rules for story submission are that it must be true, it must have happened to you, it must have happened in Alaska, ideally be told in 12 minutes or less. The easiest way is often to grab a friend to listen to you and pull out a phone to record. And we'll see you at our next big live event on February 28th, 2026 in Fairbanks, Alaska. We've probably all had a midlife crisis, or heck, a few. For some, it's a new sports car or a new relationship. I myself took a few months off to go backpacking along the West Coast, but not all of us so thoroughly upend our lives by quitting our jobs, leaving our families behind, and moving to a small, remote town in Alaska like Nicole Allard did. She discovers the hard way why preparation for winter starts really early and what warm hearts Alaskans have for each other. Here's Nicole.
I never really thought of myself as the kind of person who just can't seem to settle down and stay put. But looking back, I've lived in 14 different cities, 9 states, and 3 countries. I've never kept a job more than 5 years, and I've dated way too many men. So I think it's safe to say that I, in fact, am one of those people. I don't really know what it was that I was looking for when, in somewhat of a midlife crisis, I quit my career on the East Coast and decided to move across the country to a small town in the middle of Alaska, 2 hours south of any substantial city, except for maybe a little bit of what we all come here in search of, adventure. And the plan was to take the summer and figure out what came next. Needless to say, by the end of the summer, I'd had a lot of adventure and still had no idea what came next. So my partner and I decided that we would stick around for the winter and just give it a shot. Of course, this also meant that we didn't prepare for winter. So mid-November, I checked on our propane, which was our main heat source at the time, and realized that we were getting kind of low. So I called up our friends who were living on the East Coast. They owned the cabin that we lived in, and told them that we were going to need some more propane. And the account was still in their name. They called up, and of course, since they were on the East Coast, they got the folks down to the lower 48 with the company and were told that they only delivered to Healy, the little town that we lived in, on Wednesdays. And they needed at least a 10-day lead time. So because it was Monday, we wouldn't be able to get fuel for another, 13 days. But this was fine. Like, we had enough. It was good to go. It was unseasonably warm. So 12 days later, I woke up to my partner William nudging me. And he's just like, "Do you smell propane?" And I rolled over and mumbled no. And I was like, in doing so, realized that, yes, in fact, I smelled propane, which meant that we were out of heat. But no big deal. It was 20 degrees, like I said, unseasonably warm. We could manage a day lighting a fire in the wood stove, bundling up, and we were going to get propane the next day. So we went out, took the rest of our firewood, and spent the day making fires. Of course, as I said, we had not planned for the winter, so it was the last of our firewood. Instead, we had spent all summer using our firewood in saunas and campfires and just having fun. So the next day, we go off to work and come back to a tag on the door saying that they had tried to deliver propane but had found a leak in the system, and so we're not able to fill up the system. It was only noon, and since they only came to Healy once a week, I figured they were probably still in town delivering stuff. And so I called up the company and was like, "Hey, so I'm home now. Do you think they'd be able to come by?" But of course, the delivery guys were already back in Fairbanks, which was 2 hours away, and they told me that the earliest they could get somebody down who was a specialist for the leak detection was 3 to 4 weeks from now, which meant that we would be without heat in the dead of winter. It was warm enough now, but it was going to be like minus 30, minus 40 before we knew it, and we had nothing. And I begged and I pleaded, and they told me that, nope, you have this account as a secondary heat source, and like, we can't change that. The begging and pleading didn't really work. They just didn't have anybody to send us. So I went to plan B. The one winter chore that I had managed to do was to kind of coordinate getting wood delivered. And I realized this was kind of maybe now a rush, and we were planning on splitting a log load of wood in my naive wisdom. I thought this was the most cost-effective way of getting wood, and we were going to split it with a neighbor who lived like 30, 40 minutes away. Not super close, but you know, it seemed to make sense in my broke state of mind. And So I messaged him and was like, hey, so we need, you know, you ready to press go? We're explain the whole situation to him. And that is when he realized that we were trying to get wood for that year, unlike him, who was trying to get wood for the following year, like a good, well-prepared Alaskan, which we were not. And so despite the fact that the very next day was Thanksgiving and he had to work, he was like, hey, I have plenty of wood. You should just come over to my place if you can get a truck and just take whatever you need. And in exchange, if you could just let the dogs out, which was great. And so I arranged to get a friend who had a truck to come with us. And the next day we drive the 30 minutes north, and things had warmed up a little bit, which is great for not having heat. Not so great for driving on snowy roads. And so we were supposed to go to the end of this little like snow road right before it turned into an ATV trail. And we were going to take the last driveway on the right. And of course we didn't see the last driveway on the right until we were just about on it. And in trying to turn in very quickly, we got the truck stuck in the mushy snow. And we tried everything to get the car out. We shoveled, we put down sticks and dirt and jackets and all the things, and eventually had to give up. And so we called a friend of a friend who had a friend that lived nearby to see if they could come give us a hand. And so while that is happening, I figure I should at least keep up my end of the bargain and let the dogs out, because that is the cheapest firewood you will ever get. So I go and I let the dogs out, and they come, the folks come and they pull out the truck. And as we're driving into the driveway, the dogs get in this fight. And all I remember is seeing my friend like yanking these dogs apart and holding them out at arm's length like a T. And so I go over and I take one of the dogs, and she lets the victim dog go. And so I'm holding on to the aggressor dog, and I'm going to stick it inside because I didn't want them to get into anything further. And as I'm leading the dog into the house, I realize that it is just trailing blood behind it. And I'm like, great, like my one task I have somehow failed at. So I put the dog inside and I call up the owner, and my partner William and our friend are just bucking up Birch and tossing it into the back of the car. And so I call up the owner and I tell him about his dog, and he says that there's some first aid stuff in the house and tells me where to go look for it and asks if I can just try to patch up the dog a little bit. And so I'm looking around in this stranger's home trying to find something, anything to bandage his dog's foot, and I'm able to find just a little bit of gauze, but the dog will not let me get at all close to it. It had this like laceration just behind its paw, and I swear, like, I could see tendons. Like, it was just, oh, it was so bad. And I felt so horrible because this guy was being so kind. I'm just thinking to myself, okay, well, I've got stitches at home, I could suture the dog, but like the last thing I want to do is be like right in this dog's face that has just attacked another dog, poking it with a needle. So I call the owner back and tell him that the dog just won't let me get close. And he asks if I can take it home until he gets off work. And I feel horrible saying that I can't, but like, I have cats, I have lots of cats. And so bringing home an aggressive dog was just not something that I was able to do. And so he calls a neighbor who lives down the street who used to mush but no longer has any dogs, and tells me that they'll take him if we can at least bring him over to the neighbor's house. And this I could do. And so while I'm doing all of this, I've cut no wood, I've moved no wood, but needless to say, the truck gets loaded full of wood with my friend and William. And so we load the dog into the back with William on top of the wood, and we drive down the street. And of course, we have to make another turn off of this snowy road, and considering our last experience of being stuck in the snow for a half hour, we decide we're just going to park in the street. Nobody is coming down it. It's just this little offshoot from the highway. The dog gets out, and we're walking the dog down, you know, like a quarter mile down to the neighbor's house. And by now, the dog has stopped bleeding. He is happy as a clam, thinking that he is just on the world's greatest adventure. And we bring them over to these folks' home, and it's Thanksgiving Day, and we've just completely interrupted their day, and they invite us in for fresh coffee and fudge, and we just sit there and have this lovely conversation, just being super welcomed into their home. And then we finally get ready to go, and as we're unloading the truck and stacking all of the firewood up, I get a call from the technician who has decided that he's going to come down on Thanksgiving to fix our propane tank. And I tell him, like, that's super great, but, like, we've gotten the stopgap and he shouldn't have to interrupt his holiday just to come give us a hand. And he's like, no, I'm almost already there. It's no big deal. And he's going to be there soon. So we finish stacking wood and I'm finishing up cooking super easy Thanksgiving dinner of, like, chicken thighs and roast potatoes on my little camp stove on top of the unplugged propane fired stove. And the technician shows up and I offer him Thanksgiving dinner, which, you know, of course he declines. And he goes and he does his thing and he comes back and says that he couldn't detect a leak. And so he just filled up our propane and went back up to Fairbanks. And, you know, like, I was already falling in love with Alaska, you know, just for its utter beauty. And, you know, more than that, like, it was this place that challenged me and it was harsh, but it wasn't a place you could survive alone. And that was how I spent my Thanksgiving, you know, finding what I was looking for, you know, heat, but also just the warmth that you get being inundated by the generosity of strangers, finding home.
Several years later, Nicole Allard still lives in Alaska, splitting her time between Fairbanks and that same town in her story, Healy, Alaska. And she's still splitting firewood, too. Thanks for listening to this Season 11 edition of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Season of Thanks episode. If you really like these stories, please consider subscribing to our podcast. We also have full recordings of all our past live events available on our Dark Winter Nights YouTube library. If you'd like to see one of our live events, our next big show will be Saturday, February 28th at 7 p.m. in Lathrop High School's Herring Auditorium. To be the first to know when tickets go on sale so you don't miss out, you could subscribe to our e-newsletter at darkwinternights.com. That's where we will always first send out notifications of when tickets will go on sale, as well as any other Dark Winter Nights news. You can also consider following us on social media on both Facebook and Instagram to see details on future events. Tonight's episode was edited by Rob Prince and Robin. Thanks for listening. Remember, these are the stories we tell up here in Alaska on Dark Winter Nights. I'm Brittany Carnes.